Number one, Congress has to act. And number two, Mexico can make so much money from the United States and so many other things, so many other assets. They have to grab it and they have to stop it. We have right now two big caravans coming up from Guatemala. Massive caravans walking right through Mexico. So Mexico's tough. They can stop them, but they chose not to. Now they're going to stop them. And if they don't stop them, we're closing the border. They'll close it, and we'll keep it closed for a long time. I'm not playing games. Mexico has to stop it.
Viva la democracia y también la libertad. Viva México.
Viva.
Viva América.
Viva.
That was President Donald Trump over the weekend making one of several threats to shut down the U.S.-Mexico border. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy April Fool's Day!
Yay!
Yeah, sure.
Unhappy April Fool's Day.
National Fact Checkers Day.
Before we start, have any of you ever done a good April Fool's gag? And I'm exempting here the phenomenal Brothers Bragg video from 5 years ago where they do the constitutionally versed internal border checkpoint cop, which is great and everyone should go look at it. But have any of you ever done anything good on April Fool's Day?
My daughter served Oreos filled with toothpaste to a guest in our home successfully.
That's
a couple years ago. I was so proud.
And did the guest just mistake them for mint Oreos because that's what mint Oreos taste like?
He took a bite of them and was deeply horrified and spit it out and was like, what the fuck? And then realized that it was a prank by a small child and had to pretend like he was delighted when he was in fact outraged.
I am pretty sure that one of my high school chums, I went to Catholic high school, called a priest and had him go over to give last rites to another friend on April Fool's.
Whoa, that's like, what's it called when you call, like, it's like swatting.
Swatting, yeah.
Except for religious.
Yeah, that's right.
Swatting.
Yeah, no.
Priesting. All
getting
right.
Doxed.
Let's,
doxed into heaven.
Let's go to our latest border shutdown. The current state of play. On Friday, the president threatened to put a gone fishing sign on the southern border unless Mexico stops northbound caravans.
Now, is it one of those clocks that'll be like, we'll be back?
Yeah.
You know,
but it doesn't have hands on it?
Yeah.
And it's always a lie, right? Because it's that time has already passed and they're not back yet because they really have gone fishing. Anyways, president said, quote, this would be so easy for Mexico to do, meaning stopping the caravans coming up from Central America. Besides, we lose so much money with them, especially when you add in drug trafficking, et cetera, that the border closing would be a good thing. This was followed Saturday by the State Department announcing that the U.S. is cutting off federal aid to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Department of Homeland Security Chief Kirstjen Nielsen, that sounds suspiciously Nordic to my ears, is characterizing the situation in Robert Francis O'Rourke's El Paso and other impacted cities as, quote, a system-wide breakdown. So, Catherine, it sounds like you libertarians were wrong. There is an emergency at the border, and thank God we have a president who understands this.
Right. So there's a couple things going on here. The first is this vague assertion like Mexico's tough. They could stop the immigrants from coming, which is weird because we can't. I mean, that's piece number one, which is like somehow Mexico needs to do something. The something is unspecified. There's a vague threat looming over our major trading partner to fully close the border. And just to be clear here, he's not talking about closing the border to immigrants. He's talking about closing the border, like shuttering traffic across the border, all forms of it, which is a disproportionate response to the problem. Even if there was a massive influx of immigrants who were bringing with them a wave of crime and drugs unprecedented in our era, which there is not. Even then, to shut down trade with Mexico would be a hugely disproportionate response and a terrible idea that will harm all Americans, but especially people who rely on cheap goods to make it through the month.
My favorite part of this was when Trump said, I'll just close the border. This is a quote. I'll just close the border, and with a deficit like we have with Mexico and have had for many years, closing the border will be a profit-making operation.
He still doesn't understand the difference between trade deficits and budget deficits.
And he also thinks...
But he's very good at creating
both. He also understands the United States as one of his, like, scam business operations, as basically like a hotel that he licensed his name to that his family will either make money on or not. It's really, really disturbing how utterly unable he is to understand the most basic elements of how trade works.
It's, you know, if we can't keep Mexicans out of jails, how are we going to keep the, you know, how are we going to keep the country free from Mexicans? It just doesn't add up.
But the fact is he is responding to a demand for this, right? I mean, you know, all of us are generally in favor of increased immigration. I think that that is the right position to hold. At the same time, Trump is not creating out of whole cloth the idea that there are lots of people who want to come here.
Well, so before we
but it's not just about people who come here. Too. Also, I mean, there is another part here, which is that if you close the border, just one second, if you close the border, you will also be closing the border to people who cross back and forth every day. So that is a huge economic engine.
People who come here and leave from here.
Yes, and that's about something like half a million people just in Texas alone.
Over $1 billion a day crosses the border every day. So it's like, because he's also going to, he's talking about shutting it down to trade. So it's not just people, it's trucks.
Right. It's about $1.5 billion worth of trade and about half a million people just in one state in Texas. Excuse me, half a million. I'm not sure. I may have said half a billion there, but half a million people just in Texas. And the economic consequences of that would be absolutely staggering for the United States. So, if you want to think of profit as, oh, it would be good for the U.S. economy, it would be awful for the U.S. economy to do this for even a few days, because even beyond the initial cost of it, it would cause panic in the markets correctly, because they would start to assume that the kind of regular trading, the economic sort of back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico that we count on and that we rely on is no longer stable. And even if it opened back up, might just close again at any moment in a way that is really, really destabilizing for an economy.
The other policy issue here, too, is that, you know, Nielsen had gone down to Guatemala, El Salvador and Honduras and had inked a deal about like helping them kind of stabilize their countries to reduce the flow of migrants. And Trump basically tore that up over the weekend. So it's another one of those things, kind of like with the Special Olympics and Betsy DeVos, where, you know, there's the official administration acting and creating a certain policy, and then it gets undermined by Trump at the very end, which is kind of bizarre when you think about it. It's as if he wants to have a crisis on the border because that strengthens his hand to do whatever the hell he wants to do.
I actually think that that's basically right. I think, we've talked about this a little bit before on the podcast, but there were people who were prior to Trump's election, to Trump taking office, worried that what he would do when his approval ratings fell was start a war. And Trump, to his credit, has not threatened to start major wars in a way that, like, you could totally imagine him just being like, yep, I'm going to start a big war because that's what will make people love me. Instead, what he has done is start a trade war and have this kind of non-military or mostly non-military, this economic war with Mexico in particular, and a war on immigrants. And that is what he has done, is to rally people around a kind of very, you know, sort of, I think, ugly and certainly racially tinged, to use a phrase.
The AP says we don't use that phrase anymore. You have to say racist or you have to shut the fuck up.
Verging on racist kind of nationalism about immigration. And I think it's, in some ways you can say, well, it's better than a war that kills hundreds of thousands of people. That's probably true, but it's pretty ugly all the same.
Catherine, speaking of better war, better than a war that kills hundreds of thousands of people, if I'm not mistaken, there is a cover story in the brand spanking new issue of Reason magazine.
That makes
an argument that trade wars are the precursor to war wars, even if you have an anti-war war president.
Yeah. So this is, you know, it is one of the rare question mark headlines. The question on the cover is, will today's global trade war spark World War III or something
similar? And what do we know about question headlines?
But I was going to say, it's one of the rare question headlines where the answer is actually, yeah, kind of, rather than no. So just to be clear, this is a great piece by Dan Dresner, who digs deep into the historic parallels between the kind of withdrawal, sort of strategic withdrawals from global trade currently being executed by the United States, and some similar moves pre-World War I, which set the stage for the kind of tinderbox Europe situation. And, you know, one of the things that he says is that, you know, sometimes people cite pre-World War I as a point against the idea that more trade equals more peace, right? That it's the biggest hole in that theory is, well, global trade was at a world historical peak right before the war to end all wars. So what do you say to that, free traders? And his answer is that actually major players in Europe had stepped back on purpose from some of their kind of entanglements explicitly so that they could enable military retaliation as an option, because they knew that they needed to back away from trade in order to prevent the destruction of their economies in the event of actual war. So that's alarming. That's an alarming parallel for where we are right now, both in terms of Mexico, but obviously much more relevantly in terms of China.
Kevin Williamson had a piece at National Review, I think over the weekend, talking about the rise.
I thought he was at the Atlantic. What happened?
Yeah. Too soon. Too soon.
Talking about the rise in nationalism, and he made the flip assertion that about 97% of the new nationalism on the right is basically an aesthetic rejection of liberalism rather than anything kind of concrete policy-wise. And the policy translation is basically looking for grand symbolic middle fingers, whether it's a big border wall, screw you guys, I'm going home, or even Brexit and other similar type of things. Is that a useful frame for thinking about the kind of Trumpian policy push and or our own set of kind of like marketing and persuasion of a different analysis and a different set of kind of policy fixes for these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right to focus on the idea of nationalism as an idea rather than, you know, something that concrete. I mean, it's symbolic. And I think the real question, because this is something that a bunch of people, including Francis Fukuyama and Mark Lilla and William Eggington, have all diagnosed as, you know, we're in an age of identity politics, including white identity politics, and the creedal dimension of America, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and we're free, and blah blah blah. Like that really isn't getting anything done.
That was
anymore.
Really inspiring.
No, but I mean, it's true. It's like, you know, people, I mean, that's Fukuyama's book on identity is interesting up to the point where he's like, then, you know, the way we revive a shared American identity is by stressing our creedal nature, and it's like, you know, that's not going to work. And I think Trump is exploiting a certain element of, again, conservatives who comprise by, you know, most surveys and stuff like that, more people call themselves conservative than call themselves liberal or libertarian. But like Christians, they believe they're a beleaguered minority here and they like to push back. I mean, we're in the golden age of trolling. And I think it's incumbent to skip to your point, Matt, because, I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, the idea of a border wall, the idea of shutting the border with Mexico. These are stupid symbolic acts that can have a lot of really bad effects in the real world. But I think more interestingly, from a libertarian point of view, what is the vision of what it means to be an American that actually takes into account more and more individualized personalities? Because this is the weird thing to me about identity politics. And I was thinking a lot about this over the weekend. When you go back 20 years or so, when the census, you know, for the first time had an other category or a multi-ethnic category, you know, we're more personalized than ever in our ethnic lives, in our every aspect of our lives. And now we're seeing both on the right and the left this reach to these really old school block identities. I mean, some of them are different, like where it's trans or it's this or that, and you have intersectionality layering them on top of one another so that one gets to speak more than the others. But, you know, we need to come up with a language that speaks to why people would want to be American and recognize that there's something unique about America, which is not some dumbbell version of American exceptionalism, but it's like a real living, breathing set of activities that we take, you know, take upon ourselves every day.
Catherine, is this your ultimate butt Gorsuch here? By which I mean, there's a lot of different accommodations, whether among out and out libertarians or people who have sympathies towards our worldview, who will point out, and rightfully so, that, hey, look, the president has slowed the amount of regulations, even gotten a few of them, got rid of them. He appointed Neil Gorsuch in particular, but to a lesser degree, some other judges who've been pretty good for our worldview. The economy has been chugging along nicely. There are libertarian arguments, or there's libertarian nicenesses to a Trump presidency that have exceeded a lot of the wailing and moaning among quite a few libertarians as of November 2016. But he always campaigned and talked like this every single day. Like his very, very first speech, which I went and reread, and I recommend everyone do, and I think I'll probably write a blog post about it. His entire speech, not just the Mexicans and the rapists, but a bunch of other aspects of it in July or August of, or June of 2015, it contains all of this type of complete misunderstanding about how the world works and flows work and things like that. So is this that for you?
Yes. Closing the border with Mexico is the ultimate butt Gorsuch, for sure. Like, you could even make a libertarian case about a border wall, or at least about the irrelevance of the border wall. I would not make that case. But there is a story you can tell about building the border wall or fighting about funding for the border wall that is not inconsistent with my understanding of true libertarianism. However, I just don't think there's a story you can tell that is consistent with any species of libertarianism that includes closing our major border, a major border of the United States, to all traffic, to trade and movement. Like, that's not libertarian.
And doing it unilaterally from the Oval Office as an act of political
executive
spite.
As an executive act of political spite. And just to be clear, it's not only that it's not libertarian, it's also just a terrible idea, right? I mean, there are things that transcend the edges of ideology, and this is one of them. You know, I don't mean to lean all the way into the Remy cliche, but like, people will die. Studies show people will die, right? It is in fact true that there are many, many normal everyday activities that people rely on to function in a normal, predictable way that will be brought to a screeching and problematic halt if Trump goes through with this.
Matt, your Tijuana Donkey Show, you know, subscription is useless now.
I was so scared by those as a teen in California, the rumor, which is almost certainly, you know, just complete urban legend stuff. You know, the football team guys would like, I went down to TJ for the Donkey Show.
I don't know what that is, but I don't want to. Please
from
don't
a simpler
tell me.
America.
Yeah, no, thankfully,
I grew up in the middle of the East Coast, and I was in a sheltered. Youth,
you would just like go to Montreal and like, those people speak French. That's crazy.
See Cirque du Soleil or something.
People came on trips to my city. Man, I didn't go to other cities.
Anyways, speaking, this is a good transition. Real men of genius. speaking of deep reason TV cuts, there's another politician who has his paw prints all over immigration policy to a degree that's not really well understood, who is in the news this week. And of course, I'm referring to hair sniffer Joe Biden.
Paw prints are all over a lot of things.
Before we get to latest Biden pre-campaign apology, he's said sorry more times than Nick Cave does in the song Thirsty Dog, I think, already. And he hasn't even started running for president yet, and maybe he won't.
How many listeners do you think know what the hell you just said?
Doesn't matter.
I was going to say, that is a sentence that probably has never existed before in all, you know, 3,000 years of human history.
And follow-up question, how many people on this podcast do you think understand what the hell you just said?
My hand is raised. My hand is raised.
Yes, thank you.
I know who Nick Cave is.
Yeah, of course.
Joe Biden wrote a wrote a bill called the
Joe Biden and the Bad Seeds.
And the Bad Seeds.
What about them?
Wrote a the 1995 Omnibus Counterterrorism Act, which on one hand, thankfully, was never passed or signed into a law. On the other hand, half of it was pretty much cut and pasted into the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which is one of the more draconian crime bills and immigration restrictions out there that really screwed with the way that we handled people who are coming into this country. And the other half of it was then, of course, cut and pasted into the 2001 Patriot Act, which Biden has bragged is a duplicate of that bill. And that's one of many or of the great accomplishments of Joe Biden. Catherine, you're a lady. And you are also a lady who spent this morning seething while looking at
really
Joe Biden's
did.
Legislative
I
record.
I really did. No,
before
thanks.
Before you get
to
into
you.
That.
Oh, it keeps getting worse. It keeps getting worse. The more you dig.
Is hair sniffing and back head kissing, as Biden has been accused of Democratic politician Lucy Flores, are those deal breakers?
I mean, like, they're extremely deal breakers to me personally. Now, I think that's a separate question of whether they should be deal breakers to America. But for those who don't know me, because I'm only a creepy voice in your ear, I really do not enjoy most people touching me ever. I would love a social equilibrium.
Even your kids.
I make a small list
limits.
Of exceptions. Yeah. And then people who are related to me, who I chose to marry, are inside the bubble and everyone else is outside it. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable stance to hold. And I will fight you. So I, in general, would love to see our entire social equilibrium just like shift at least one standard deviation, like away from people touching each other. And people like Joe Biden are the ones who are stopping that important social progress. Joe Biden gets this pass. He gets this pass. And people like him get this pass where it's like, well, he's just friendly. He's offering support and comfort and shoulder massages. And who doesn't like those things? And the answer is lots of people don't like those things, but especially lady people in professional contexts. And I don't think that that should be hand waved away. So that's my little I don't like people touching me soapbox speech. But I do actually want to like have a slightly more relevant to other humans listening to this podcast talk, which is Biden's history of dealing with and talking about people who are different than him, including racially different, but also women people, it's super consistent. He is constantly getting in trouble for saying stuff like, oh, ha ha, all the 7-Elevens around here, they have the funny accents, or all my cab drivers are Somali, I love the Somalis, or I really wish I could have done something for Anita Hill when he could have done anything he wanted. He was in charge of that process. Like this is a pattern.
He could have put
with
his hands on her shoulders.
He could have given her a shoulder massage in a difficult time. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he has always bragged that he was basically responsible for the Violence Against Women Act, often in direct rebuttal to like, Joe Biden, you seem to be a bit like of a creepster who sort of molests women. And he's like, but the Violence Against Women Act, which is not a good response. I was reading around this morning and discovered the ACLU's original response to the Violence Against Women Act, which I don't know if y'all know this, but they opposed it. And they said the increased penalties were rash, that the increased pretrial detention was repugnant to the U.S. Constitution, that the mandatory HIV testing for those charged, not convicted, was an infringement on the citizen's right to privacy, and that the edict for automatic payment of full restitution was non-judicious, which that's true. That's an accurate description. And then, of course, as you know, parts of the Violence Against Women Act were later struck down, the federal civil remedies for violence against women, because they exceed the proper understanding of the Commerce Clause. Like, interpersonal violence within a state is not the business of the federal government, is a totally correct interpretation. So it was a bad law that infringed on all kinds of people's privacy. And it had women in the name. And so Biden was like, look, I'm ladies' friends. He's bad.
He's like Bob Dylan. You know, he's been around for 60 years and he has greatest hits in every decade.
Right. And this is what I'm saying, right? This is one little slice. This is just like a brief tour of Biden's terrible relation to women. And you could do this same brief tour for crime. You could do the same brief tour for immigration. You could do the same brief tour
for drug war.
You could do the same brief tour for the drug war. And he has a long, messy record, which has been incurred because he is someone who is a political opportunist with a big head.
Nick, what's your favorite piece of Biden blight over the years?
I mean, you know, the best has got to be the when he in 88, when he plagiarized Neil Kinnock, the labor British labor politician's life story when he was running for president.
People don't realize it wasn't just like some words in a speech. It was like details
it was like
of a life
about
story.
His dad. Yeah, his dad, the coal miner or something like that. And it's like, you know, even in 1988, people are going to check. I mean, come on. You know, it's just, yeah, the whitewash that he got by becoming Obama's vice president is fascinating because almost overnight he was turned from a national joke into like, you know, our great national grandfather or something like that, a man of wise, you know, wise opinions and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm curious to see if he makes it out of the starting blocks at all, even because it does seem to me he's both eminently, he is somebody along with Bernie Sanders who could stand on a stage with Donald Trump and not get distracted and actually engage Trump in a way that could conceivably be interesting and politically successful. But he's just so terrible. And he more than Sanders, even, you know, is a throwback to the 20th century. And it's just like, man, you know, just go. OK, you had a great run to get the hell out.
Peter, I was thinking that just even as Nick was saying that there is this weird like allergy, hostility out there that people have towards stuff that reminds them of the early Obama days. And it's not an anti-Obama thing. It's just sort of like we don't live in that world anymore. The world has gone darker. Don't give me this. And I'm thinking over the weekend, Beto O'Rourke, who like re-kicked off his presidential campaign in Texas with a bunch of rallies. He was tweeting out all this kind of like, you know, life poster motivational type of claptrap kind of stuff off of Obama's lips. You know, we are more than our aspirations. We must come together. I'm just like throwing Mad Libs out there, but it was basically that. And people are like, no, I'm not having this anymore. Whereas they could during Obama. And I wonder if there's an element to play that with a response to Joe Biden. Like the selling proposition of Joe is, hey, Uncle Joe, remember, he's a guy who balanced out the inexperienced and kind of like a fresh talking senator there. And he, you know, he's been around for a long time, really knows how things, lunch buckets, Scranton, whatever. And it's like, no, we don't live there anymore. And so
don't forget Amtrak.
Amtrak. Oh, my God. Amtrak. So
he's like the air admiral of Amtrak, right? He has more Amtrak miles than anyone.
There's basically a stop on the Acela that exists because of Joe Biden.
Which one is it?
The one he uses.
Wilmington?
I don't even,
Wilmington.
I mean, like, it's
Wilmington is the murder capital of America or something, too, which is kind of great.
He's sort of, do you think that he's a paper tiger in the pre-election polling? People recognize his name and Bernie Sanders' names, but like, can you see him surviving the intersectionality Olympics in a period where we have like Democrats, not even we, but are like they're done with the vague uplift of 2007 Barack Obama?
I think the big question is whether Betsy DeVos is going to defund the intersectionality Olympics and whether we're either, whether we're even going to have them.
Well, Trump will restore the funding
heroically.
Yeah, so
it'll be fine.
So I don't know the answer to that question, and it's really interesting. Joe Biden is a symbol of the old Democratic Party, not just of the Obama era. Obviously, sort of that's where he was the most prominent, but of the Clinton era in a way that is really, I think, off-putting to a lot of Democratic activists. But Democratic activists, while very important in electing a presidential nominee, very important in this kind of pre-process that we're in, this full year before there are actually any elections, they're the loudest and most committed voices. They get the most press. They influence what the candidates say and do in a huge way. The activists are not the entire Democratic Party, or I'm not sure they represent most Democratic voters, especially in a national election. And I say I'm not sure genuinely because I'm actually not sure. I kind of don't know where the Democratic Party is right now, but it's very clear that there's a big rift, a big split. And Biden represents kind of the old consensus. Not just because of his age, but because of his experience, because he voted for the Iraq War, because he kind of owns most of the Democratic Party's sort of moderate kind of signature policies for the last 30 years. And so it is a big question right now whether or not the Democratic Party as a whole is going to embrace that. I think the activists clearly are not going to. What I would say, though, is that the party establishment, I think, is. And if you look at sort of elite political actors amongst Democrats, with a few exceptions, mostly people who are quite committed, either running for president for the nomination or quite committed to the campaign of somebody else, the rest of the Democratic Party is still pretty comfortable with the Biden model and the Biden persona. And so there is going to be there's going to be a bit of a battle here between the Democratic establishment that has existed and sort of built a power center for itself, mostly in Washington over the last several decades, and the new, somewhat angrier in certain ways, somewhat more concerned with identity politics, Democratic activist class. And it's not clear to me how that is going to shake out over the course of the next 2 years.
And just to put a button on the idea that most Democrats, according to Pew, a poll that came out earlier this year, 54% of self-identified Democrats want a more moderate party. Only 40% want a more progressive one. So there is a real, you know, there's a real battle going on between the activists and most of the candidates. I also think, in a way, and this is where somebody like Biden and to a lesser degree Bernie Sanders, but as old white men, if they can bring in the identity, like the various kind of avatars of identity politics into the Democratic Party, that potentially blunts a lot of the fears, I think, that anti-Trump people have. Because I think a lot of people who are, you know, kind of lukewarm on Trump may vote for him if you get somebody who presents as a very extreme and kind of new identity.
If I have to bet
in American politics,
if I have to bet, Joe Biden is not the nominee. I think that ultimately he doesn't bring enough that is unique and positive in terms of what Democratic primary voters are, I think, want to the table. I don't think he brings enough to overcome what are the baggage that he is also going to bring, like, from several decades worth.
Hillary Clinton brought enough to compensate for her baggage.
Also, she used her power to knock everybody else out of the race up front.
Biden
doesn't have that kind of power. And that's, I think, itself telling that if Biden were a likely nominee, right, if he were sort of the person who had been chosen by the party establishment and was just going to get it because he had been chosen and everybody was okay with that, the field would be much, much smaller and would look comparatively weaker rather than this very wide open race that we have.
Well, I also think the idea of, like, Beto as baby Biden is is real. Like, I mean, let's all just, like, you know, that's a horrifying, like, face swap on one of those Snapchat things. But, like,
it's a deep fake.
It's a deep fake. But, yeah, the idea of, okay, listen, broadly speaking, there's a demand on the Democratic side to not nominate an old white man, though there are lots of sort of inertial forces that still draw in that direction. To have, baby Biden Beto, who is also sort of sincere and his sleeves are rolled up and he's just a nice dude, maybe. And even, I suppose, Pete Buttigieg, who is a gay baby Biden. I don't know. This got upsetting. But the existence of these sort of energetic young white dudes in the pool hopefully dilutes and rearranges some of the priors around on existing biases to still just be like, well, I'd like a sincere dude who rolls up his sleeves and is going to seem like I could have a beer with him in Iowa win. There's that Biden vote can be spread around.
But let's also be clear, Beto, while a quite flawed candidate in many ways, is so much better.
Oh, yeah,
than
from
Joe
a policy
Biden.
Perspective as well as from a disposition perspective.
As is Mayor Pete. As is Mayor Pete.
As is Mayor Pete.
As is Mayor Pete.
You guys, can we briefly...
No, I mean, like, I don't want to say that I think these guys would be great presidents who I would just fully support. That's not what I'm saying.
But if we're doing rank ordering, I'm going to put Beto over Biden for sure.
Absolutely.
On a raw, just a pure, like, what kind of president would he actually be?
He is a Democrat who has talked about spending cuts and budget deficits in ways
for the last time.
Reasonably
for the last
yes,
time.
Yes, for the last time.
We will never hear it
but
again.
The fact that he's done it at all, the fact and the fact that he's acknowledged that shows that he has the capacity to.
Cheap
I
date.
Think what the back, you know, the subtext of all of this, Matt, and it goes back to the piece I read after seeing Trump give his, you know, his mind-blowing, you know, 2.5 hour long riff at CPAC. There's no way the Democrats are going to beat Trump in 2020. Like, unless something really goes haywire.
Why
would you make a confident prediction about American politics
few months ago on this podcast?
He is going to eke out a win with like 44% of the popular
vote. Not predict?
It's Temple basketball.
Did you not predict that he would drop out and not be running for president?
You know what?
Yes.
If you make all
absolutely.
The predictions, one of them will
absolutely.
Be right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're gonna close the Reason Podcast vault here.
The midterms that he would drop out. I still think that would be the smart money move for him.
I am going to go ahead and pre-write I want to pre-write my think piece on what it means if America's first man. Is married to a man like that's that this
yeah.
is because
oh,
I think like
good, yeah.
like everyone else in my, oh my God, social that's... demographic I followed Chasten Buttigieg on Twitter this week. He is clearly winning the candidate spouse sweepstakes right now by just being extremely millennial
Palin.
On Twitter.
He's the Todd Palin of 2020.
Don't be mean to my guy Chasten like that. Yeah.
Well, Todd was a good. He was going to be the first dude.
He was going to be
and
the
like,
first
ride snowmobiles
dude.
On the yeah. Over
Chasten
the Rose Garden.
Is,
stuff.
I'm pretty sure
it was
would not
be great.
Describe himself as the first dude, but I do feel like there's 1,000 think pieces waiting to be written if we wind up having the first man be.
Have we polled millennial Mayor Pete yet as to whether is he one of these millennials who's not having sex?
Oh, good transition.
Like that, he is married. You know?
Dude, the panic
so,
over
you
how...
say that as if that means anything. Yeah. Like, does that mean that he's
the
more
or less
likely
to have sex? The panic over how the Youngs are not having sex and also the panic over how the Youngs are having sex. Like, the total inability to win on those statistics really is astonishing, right? Like, I'm old enough to remember when we were worried because the young people were having too much sex.
What is the right amount? Like, can someone do a study?
Yeah.
Extremely Suderman voice.
I want to read like a 37 tweet thread from Megan McArdle.
I'm pretty sure Vox will probably have that scientific.
The right amount of sex, comma, explained.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a Zach Beauchamp. Whatever Zach Beauchamp is having.
There is
plus
no
5%.
Need to single out individual writers here.
I'm just kind of is. Speaking of getting screwed, Nick, yeah. There's an op-ed over the weekend in the Washington Post by Mark Zuckerberg, whatever his name is, the Zuck. And I think you're going to write about this, and you're not happy about it.
It's already up, my friend.
It's the internet needs new
rules.
I'm
the John Henry of reason. I'm a steel-driving man, Matt. My piece on why Mark Zuckerberg begging for regulation, calling for regulation, which he did a year ago anyway, is really it's the end of an era. And I you know, part of me, it's just getting fucking old. But it's like when you look at the internet 20 years ago, it was a different space and it was more open, and the people who were building it stressed the need for openness. And you know, you go back and you read John Perry Barlow, who died last year, his Declaration of Independence in cyberspace, it brings tears to my eyes.
It's science fiction at this point.
Yeah, I mean, where there was a new world that was aborning, and the whole point of it was that the people who were building it would create rules and you would opt in or opt out. And it seems to me in a way, in a profound way, I'm not a big fan of Facebook, but it has created this incredible space that just doesn't exist without it being there. And part of, you know, part of the greatness of it is that there's billions of people on it. But all of the tools are there for us to regulate what we see and what we do on Facebook. And the idea now, you know, just that, you know, Facebook and other tech companies, I mean, they're mature industries and they are openly calling for government regulation. We have a video up that we did last year where Zuckerberg, you know, in front of Congress is saying, like, I will help you write these regulations and realize that, you know, we can absorb the costs of these regulations that we help you write. Smaller companies won't be, there won't be competitors to Facebook. And that won't last forever. But like, they are openly talking about like regulatory capture and public choice dimensions across all types of tech industries. And it's deeply disturbing to me because, you know, that's it. Like, you know, we got to find someplace else now.
I was trying to describe the dynamic of Baptists and bootleggers to someone this weekend as a way of explaining what was going.
Not liquors, in case people.
No, that's exactly what I was just about to say is I probably did whatever I just did then. And they were like, I'm sorry, did you say Baptists and bootlickers? And I was like, yeah, also that, like, that's not wrong. You know, the idea that he has doubled down on this message of like, you guys and us guys, we're reasonable people. We'll work together to figure out the right thing for Americans about what they're allowed to do and not do. Like, there is a bootlickers component to the Baptist and bootleggers coalition. I guess it actually goes both ways, because I'm sure that we will be hearing about how Mark Zuckerberg is a great American pretty soon, like the more that he gets entwined with the state. But like,
he's a good corporate citizen.
It's just like, if you don't like big government, don't like this. If you don't like big business, don't like this. That should get everyone. That should round up the whole American population. And they should be like, I don't like this. And yet this is definitely going to happen.
Yeah. And, you know, it's partly it's a global phenomenon because Facebook and Google and other tech companies are facing massive fines and developments in the way that the EU in particular is regulating, pushing regulations and whatnot. So I understand all of the competitive pressures. And from a probably from a kind of corporate CEO standpoint, he's doing exactly the right thing. But this is where it's depressing as hell, you know, because it's the end of an era. And I think the open internet era, people were worried about, you know, how not having net neutrality was going to fuck up the internet. It's like net neutrality is nothing. This is, you know, this is the clampdown by the people, the biggest tech companies on the planet are now saying, okay, it's time, you know, we get it. We need to be regulated.
I think part of it is,
and that's not good.
Part of it is that Zuckerberg sees himself as running an empire, not just a corporate empire. And who is his biggest sort of rival at this point? It is, frankly, in a lot of ways, the U.S. government. And what do big corporations like Facebook do when they see big rivals? They merge with them, try to buy them, right? Like, that's what they did with Instagram. That's, you know, then when Snapchat sort of came along, they just sort of stole Snapchat.
Oculus, right? Or whatever.
And so what I think Zuckerberg thinks he's doing is trying to do here is to co-opt the power of his biggest rival, the biggest threat to his business, which is the federal government, and make it his partner. And that will take it off the table and also potentially give him a stake in the way the federal government regulates all, not just him, but all of his competitors. And I mean, it is, you know, it's probably, as you said, Nick, it is probably at least in the short term, the smart business strategy, just sort of in terms of thinking about what you're going to need to do as a business in order to survive. But it's awful. And I think people who are skeptical of government or people who are skeptical of big corporations should certainly be opposed to this.
And there's been this resurgence, right, of interest in antitrust. I mean, you know, I missed last week's podcast because I was up in Boston talking to the Harvard people because I'm extremely fancy. And
on a yacht.
On a yacht. Mm. That's where they do all the things. You know, we were talking about this topic. And the number of people who felt that the solution to this question lay in the realm of antitrust was astonishing to me, because these are the same people. It's the same faulty, buyable, swayable humans who are going to look at this question of, is Facebook too big? And answer, yes, it's too big.
Therefore, it should merge Therefore, with the federal government?
Therefore, it should basically merge with the federal government. I mean, this is how we solved the student loan crisis, quote unquote. We were like, this industry is enormous and completely broken. I know. Let's merge it with the federal government. And now it's bigger and more broken.
It'll be interesting to see how, you know, people like Elizabeth Warren in particular, who has explicitly called for the breakup of Facebook in its current configuration, how does she respond to this kind of stuff? Because, you know, and I'm sure she'll say it depends on the regulation or whatever. But, you know, again, that's why Zuckerberg is kind of smart. I mean, Facebook's average daily users, its revenues and things like that in North America, its most profitable zones, is flatlining, if not declining. You know, it's a very savvy move, but it's also one that really should just be called out.
The big tech companies learned from Microsoft's experience, where Microsoft in the 1990s basically thought, Washington, we don't need to deal with them. We're in Seattle and we make software that allows you to make spreadsheets. That's what we do. Why in the world would we need a Washington office? And they found out why, which was because the federal government spent about a decade going after Microsoft, threatening, in some cases quite seriously, like to break up Microsoft, to force the company not just to alter some of its business practices, which is what did happen in the end, but there was a very strong movement to break up Microsoft. It ultimately failed. But that taught all the big tech companies on the West Coast a lesson that you can't ignore the East Coast power center of the federal government, that you have to have a huge presence here and you have to be involved because, you know, as the cliche goes, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're being served at it.
You are the table.
You're in the room where it happened. No, I'm confused. I also want to just say very briefly, I do think one possible Elizabeth Warren answer here is, okay, if we break up these big entities, whether it's Amazon, Facebook, you know, the players that she's gone after, one solution for them is to be so entangled in the regulatory state that even after the various parts of their business are broken up, they are essentially still able to coordinate the behavior of those parts of the business through the mechanism of regulation, right? That if you keep all of other players out, and if you control price setting or volume of trade or whatever it is, you're still coordinating the different parts of your business. You're just doing it through the mechanism of the SEC or of, you know, whatever relevant players wind up, you know, probably some new thing Elizabeth Warren will invent and staff and then we'll never be able to get rid of. So that is, in fact, a wildly inefficient way to coordinate the different parts of your business. But if the alternative is to smash your business on the rocks, then they will take it.
And, you know, conceivably for Zuckerberg's, you know, announcement of the op-ed right now also has to do with New Zealand and the shooting. And fascinatingly, the shooter in New Zealand live streamed on Facebook, supposedly for about 30 minutes. About 400 people saw it in live time, and then about 2,000 after it, you know, it stopped, but it was still online and viewable. And, you know, it's amazing because people are like, well, Facebook should have been quicker in taking that down. Or it's like Facebook takes down all sorts of stuff without due process, et cetera. I think that the social media platforms made a major, major mistake. And it's similar to the way that the tobacco companies at a certain point said, OK, we're going to fight, you know, product liability by making shit up and saying, well, no, smoking is actually good for you, you know, and stuff like that, and creating a whole fake scientific industry. Facebook and these other Twitter. And again, I realize we've had these arguments, but like they should have said, you know what, we're not fucking moderating stuff. Actually, it's up to individual users. That's what we do. We give you the tools to moderate and regulate what you see and what you put up there.
Twitter kind of tried for a hot minute.
Yeah. And then they caved. They caved. And it's bad because it ends up saying, like, you know, that we have to control what our users see in a way that is undoable, because it's like, I mean, you know, there's hundreds of thousands, there's millions of users, there's billions of users. How the fuck does anybody keep track of that? It's just it was bad move, guys.
Maybe it's the kind of equivalent of there's some law, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but like 90% of everything is crap. It's a Sturgeon's law, and so And this is true of, you know, fans of movies, books, whatever you want.
This podcast.
This podcast.
I thought that was, it was going to be like an actual law type law, like, you know, statute 1305A.
U.S. code.
Yeah.
Yep. It's like the whole crime a day. By the way, I'm just going to throw this out here. That whole crime a day Twitter feed. There's never a link in there. I think they're made up. Until I have hear someone saying these are actually
crime a day truther.
I'm a crime a day truther. I'm
registering.
You should
be like all these people about Lucy Flores who have decided that the right line is to say, I have no reason to believe she's making it up. That's like the new thing people are saying. We have no reason to believe they're making those up.
I do everything's because a crime. As Catherine, as we were discussing in the office last week when I was making a rare visit, I still use 1990s style hyperlinking in my writing on the internet. I haven't increased.
Is it even really a word in a blog post if it's not also a hyperlink?
But the internet has left me behind, and so now like people notice that I'm like a aggressive hyperlinker. When I'm not, I'm just the
also
same
why
as
are
that.
You making us say hyperlink? No one's even used. It's like the cyber hyperlinks
exactly
on the internet superhighway.
And so I distrust because I want to verify things without hyperlinks. Damn it! I was going to give Suderman 90 seconds to tell us about what the hell's happening with Obamacare, but I'm going to override that and I await for these explanations to appear on the blog, including Mitt Romney's apparent late entry, although I think that's an April Fool's gag of rewriting whatever happens to our healthcare law. But let's go into our what the hell have you people been consuming portion of the podcast since I should, before I start that, shout out to the guy who approached me and Nick at the bathroom of New York Midtown restaurant, basement bathroom of a restaurant, and said that he was listening to this podcast. Dude, thank you. That was that was awesome. And we've been bragging about that on our internal Slack channels aggressively, and everybody else out there who has said kind things to us recently in various locales listening to this. It makes us happy. And the thing that they talk about is this part of the podcast, because pretty much everyone's like, yeah, I'm with Catherine and Peter, which is so weird to me. I don't even begin to understand. Catherine, what the hell have you been consuming?
I'm now going to lean so hard into this. Okay, so what I've been consuming, first a little backstory. I read about it in The Stranger, which is a truly great publication that everyone should be reading. Home of Dan Savage, the great sex advice columnist, and also Katie Herzog, the only sane person left on the internet, I think, in terms of LGBT issues and also like housing policy. She's great. I thought that this was a Katie Herzog post. I read the whole post. I subscribed to the podcast mentioned in it, only to discover that it was actually a post by someone else. Queens of Adventure. It is Dungeons, Dragons, and Drag Queens. It's amazing. It's just a podcast in which a group of drag queens narrate their adventures. They are right now stranded on Fire Island.
So are they playing the game on the podcast, or are they?
They are playing the game,
reciting what happened.
They
are
playing the game in real time on the podcast as their drag personas, and it couldn't be more delightful.
So are they what class are they? Are they like drag?
Yeah, no, it's like Harlot O'Scara, the half elf. I think she might be actually a tiefling. And they land, and the beginning of the story is like, you wash up on the beach, your wig is gone, your lashes are off. What do you do next? It's absolutely delightful. Enjoy it now before drag becomes too problematic and we all have to stop.
Or Dungeons and Dragons.
Speaking of The Stranger, I will go next because The Cure, the great Camus-quoting rock goth mope band, was inducted on Friday into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nearby here, which my wife reminds me ruefully. She did not have tickets to attend at Barclays Center. You can watch the induction on April 27th on HBO. Cure's a great band. They probably should have been nominated before, in my humble opinion. And so I was just watching people's various phone videos from inside Barclays Center, their live five-song set there. which included the hits Boys Don't Cry and Just Like Heaven, and also deep cuts like A Forest. But the main selling point of all of it, that's a fan favorite going way back for reasons that I still can't quite understand. It's pretty amazing to see who is now like a 60-year-old dude out there. Trent Reznor gave the introductory speech and pointed out accurately that it's this marvelous instrument of Robert Smith's voice. Still got it. I saw that. We saw them like a couple years ago in the hellhole known as Madison Square Garden. And it's just kind of amazing from a physical point of view to still have the breadth and the range of Robert Smith's voice. It's a glorious thing. They're still on tour. Go check them out, despite the guitar noodlings of former Bowie sideman Reeves Gabrels. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I was going to make a hoping that Robert Smith and Janet Jackson, another inductee, would sing harmony or something on a One Wig Dove for Stevie Nicks.
Did anyone see the Sean Penn movie in which he plays a Robert Smith lookalike character who discovers that he needs to go and hunt Nazis? I know that all sounds insane, and I recently had the opportunity to look that up on YouTube and show it at a raclette party at our house, and people were like spitting cheese out through their nose. It was so incredibly great. I think it's a straight-to-video movie from 2 or 3 years ago. Go check it out. Sean Penn, Robert Smith, Holocaust, hunting. Go, Nick.
Wow. Over the weekend, I watched The Brink, a new documentary about Steve Bannon and his reign of terror over U.S. and increasingly European politics. It's a really good documentary. It's made by Allison Hayward, I think. I might be getting her last name. She also did Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, which is also a fantastic documentary. I think Bannon's influence is overstated, but there's a moment in that where she basically gets him to say openly that, you know, what he's doing is creating identity politics for white people in the United States. And I think she misunderstands a little bit that what he's also doing is conjuring up extreme identity politics among people on the left, and that he's confident, and I think he's right to be confident for the next election cycle or two, that if it comes down to white identity politics versus new identity politics, the white identity politics will win the White House for at least one, possibly two more terms. But it's really a fascinating look. And it wasn't that long ago. Remember when Bannon was being deplatformed everywhere, whether it was the New Yorker Book Festival or, you know, Errol Morris's documentary didn't really get a showing because people were like, it would be unethical to even discuss Steve Bannon. That's a big mistake because he does represent a point of view that is important and needs to be kind of confronted and combated. I think he and the left are very similar in the way that they define what makes a nation. And it's a, you know, there is one identity that is going to get pushed on to everyone. And that's problematic. We need to create, I think this is the challenge for libertarianism right now, is to create a workable understanding of pluralism where there is real strength and diversity and also a common purpose that defines us in a way that allows us to not be, you know, shutting the border with Mexico every time Donald Trump has a conniption.
The creed, man. It's about the creed. Suderman, what creeds have you been slaughtering in first person shooter games?
I actually did not play any video games over the weekend. I read a full new Tana French novel, The Witch Elm, but that's not what I'm going to talk about because I saw Blade Runner on the big screen at AFI Silver in Silver Spring, right outside of Washington, D.C. I mean, the original Blade Runner, 1982, not Blade Runner 2049, the one that just...
And not the director's cut?
So this is, in fact, I did see what is known as the final cut, which is the 2007 reinterpretation of the 1992 director's cut.
Voiceover or no voiceover?
So there's no voiceover. There is a unicorn dream, and they also, they fixed a bunch of technical issues, including, famously... for example, when he goes to Animoid Row to look for the scales that he found in one of the replicants' apartments, he tracks these down. He goes and he sees the fish lady who makes robot fish because this is a world kind of where there aren't really animals anymore, or where animals are very rare and very expensive. And she says, no, it's not a fish scale. It's a snake scale. But she reads the serial number off the scale after looking through in a microscope. And in the original versions, even through the director's cut, she reads the wrong serial number. It doesn't match what's on screen. Then later he goes and talks to the snake guy who actually made it. And if you see the any cut up through 1992, the mouths don't match the dialogue at all. They just don't, like, what Harrison Ford is saying when he talks to the snake robot builder is not what he's saying. And then for the final cut, this is the 2007 re-edit, what they did was they had Harrison Ford's son come in and actually do the correct, make the correct lip motions, and then they inserted that on top of Harrison Ford's mouth in the movie. So fixed a bunch of technical things like that. But it just sort of, I mean, I've seen this on the big screen. This is the second time, but I've probably seen this movie 50, 100 times straight through and a couple of hundred times in fragments. It's a movie I've been watching. Now, I was thinking about this. The first time I saw it, I was 9 years old. I watched a videotaped version that my dad had recorded off of Fox, I think. And I was watching it on like a little 13-inch screen, you know, pan and scan with commercials, and also it was VHS, so like the quality was really bad. And there were like bits of it that I didn't understand at all, just because there wasn't enough screen there. You couldn't see what was going on, in particular in a sequence where he zooms in. He basically scans a photo and then zooms in to see something that is reflected in a mirror in the photo. And you like, just couldn't see what was happening. But I've been watching this movie for so much of my life, for probably about 3/4 of my life now. And it's just like,
I feel like I've been listening to you talk about this movie for 3/4 of my life now.
Yeah, and right, and it just got me thinking about like the way you carry these things, these works of art. Anybody who kind of cares about pop culture or narrative or movies or whatever.
It really is one of the great and I guess you're technically kind of more than one text, but in the way that The Godfather, both the novel and the movie, informed in 30 years or more of American popular culture. And I think Blade Runner has that reach, and it becomes a background. It's fascinating.
Background, not just to American pop culture, but to my own mind. Like, it's just sort of there all the time. I think, so my favorite novel is Fahrenheit 451. And in the end, you go to this, you end up in this colony where everybody has like memorized a book and they've basically become the book. And I kind of think that there's like some truth to that, right? There's like, that's an appealing ending in a lot of ways, which is that you become, you know, the things that you consume become part of you and shape who you are, but also you become them. And there's like some weird way in which, you know, part of my brain is always projecting Blade Runner in a little theater in my mind.
Do you see a connection to that with other Philip K. Dick work? Because I mean, we really, I think in a profound way, we're living in Philip K. Dick's universe, which is not that great a place to hang out.
Philip K. Dick,
I mean,
obviously
kind of interesting,
inspired a lot of that. But, you know, I mean, if you really want to sort of the whole backstory, one of the best books about making a movie ever is Paul M. Salmon's Future Noir, which is the book that takes you through not like the entire process, not just like on set, but all the development, all the different versions of the screenplays, all the fights to get it financed, you know, the going over budget, how they built all the sets, how they did all the effects work, just every little detail. And you really see that it's Philip K. Dick inspired, certainly, but it's really Hampton Fancher and Ridley Scott. Much more than it is like a Philip K. Dick tale.
I agree completely, and I think that you can say the same thing about Amazon's Man in the High Castle, but it's fascinating to me that Dick is kind of like, he wrote the outlines of these things that then get created into like living virtual universes that I agree with you have like a really profound effect. Certainly on the way that I think.
I mean, it gave
us
the visual language for what we thought the future should look like in a lot of ways.
Right.
If you go to Times Square, it just looks like a happy version of Blade Runner, right?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
It's a positive, commercialized sort of like super dense screens everywhere, canyon of buildings, and it's wonderful. And I think that was the big thing that Blade Runner got wrong, was that Blade Runner sort of looked at this at the future of super dense urban living, where, you know, sort of there was just like commercialization of literally everything and sort of kind of stacked on top of each other, and thought, well, this will be sort of grim and dark and awful. And you know what? We have that now in a lot of our cities, and it's kind of great.
Well, that's spoken like someone who hasn't seen the naked skateboard cowboy in a long time. Or
I saw him last month.
I think that's all the anyway. Self-projection into books that we have time for here. I think I'm going to go and become the Bill James historical baseball abstract yet again here. Thank you for listening. Please keep approaching, especially Nick, in public bathrooms whenever possible, and give us direct feedback, and also feedback online at the various places you subscribe to this podcast. And stay tuned for other such podcasts. And goodbye. Happy April Fool's Day. Don't play any pranks. None of them are funny. Bye.